I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little weepy. I have a sobriety date. It's January 12th of 1992. I have a sponsor. Her name is Debbie. She also has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. I have a home group. It's the Midtown Group. We meet in Wilmington, North Carolina on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. If you're ever there, we would love to have you. It's always an honor and a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm kind of like, I've been like a little teary, and I don't know if it's because of the anniversary or the countdown, but I have such a love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and my tribe is so big, you know, and the people in my life today as a result of doing some things I really did not want to do when I got here is just so beautiful, and getting to spend time with those people and, you know, my good friend Patty and Rusty that they give me a room, and they call it my room. It's my room at their house. So if you ever stay with them, I'll let you stay in my room, you know? And my good friend Kathy, she paid for that. She took a flight here, and she paid a lot of extra money so that she could see me tonight. And the women in my life are just so amazing, you know, and I just feel so blessed that I get to have these people. And I have a couple of girls that I brought with me from Wilmington that are newly sober, and I just tell them, get in the car, right? And one of them I sponsor. My friend Sylvia, she thinks her name is get in the car because I'm just like, we're just hoping it's going to rub off, you know. And hopefully I'll talk a little bit about that sponsorship and the women in my life, because we have a Friday night meeting that we meet at my house, and it's not exclusive. It's whoever wants to come and hears about it. We want you there. We have people from out of town that just randomly show up at my house, right? And we have snacks and we fellowship, and then we have this meeting, and I'm just so blessed, because I can tell you that a year ago, probably even 9 months ago, I had never gotten to a place in Alcoholics Anonymous where it was hard for me to go to meetings, you know, that there was a struggle for me to go. And I can tell you that the new women in Alcoholics Anonymous are what brought everything alive again for me, you know. And sometimes trudging, it is to walk with that purpose, but sometimes it's super hard. And what my experience is that if I keep doing the things that are suggested, the blessings that I have, the women in my life and men in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous are just limitless, you know. I live a really grateful, blessed life. So I'm going to share with you guys in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you listen to my story and you think, I don't have anything in common with that human being, keep coming back, because hopefully you're going to hear your story. And I was fortunate. I heard my story early on. I was 90 days sober, and I heard June G give her talk. And she had curly red hair, and she was a biker girl, and she was rough around the edges, and she cursed like a sailor. And she got here at 13 years old and never picked up a drink, right? And when I listened to her, half my head was shaved. I wore combat boots and wore black lips and black eyes. And, you know, I thought I was tough. And I hear this story, and I was like, well, maybe I can not pick up a drink too. So keep coming back before the miracle happens, right? So I grew up in Texas, right outside of Dallas. I have an older brother, younger half-sister. I usually don't talk about my sister a lot because we didn't grow up in the same household together. My brother and I were a year apart, so he was really the only friend I had, because I was so awkward, y'all. I hated the way that I looked. I hated my red hair. I would wrap my little fingers around my hair and rip it out. I just hated the way that I looked. I felt weird and awkward. And my mom, you know, she was like blonde, and everybody in Texas has big blonde hair. You know, it's like, that's the thing. And so I just, and I say this also to let you know that that was just my thing, because I sit in meetings of AA, and so many of us talk about the things that we felt separated us. And what I know is that it wasn't the red hair that separated me, right? I had this thing from early on where I just didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. Now, I could adapt. You put me in a situation, and I will adapt and overcome that situation, right? I'm a survivor and a fighter kind of a girl. But I never had that sense of belonging. And I didn't react normally to life either. If my feelings got hurt, I would start slamming my head in a wall. And so, like, my little nephew, he does that now. My mom called me. She said, "I'm really worried about Austin. He's slamming his head in the wall." You know, like, I'm like, I get that because I watch that. And not all children are like that. But when I see little kids like that, that are just, you know, really emotional and volatile like that, I'm like, I get it. Because that's just what I was from an early age. And one of the things that I've learned through step work and just being around here for a while is that some of the things that happened when I was growing up were super traumatic. And for a long time, in the first few years that I was here, I really thought they were a big reason as to why I was the way that I was. What I know is that none of that stuff is as a result of why I'm alcoholic. Like, the reason I'm alcoholic is how my body, my mind reacts to alcohol. But I thought that that was, had a lot to do with it. And I also only remembered the really bad things too. And I see pictures, and there's pictures of me being happy as a kid too. So I just want you to know that that also is part of my truth. Because it's really easy for me to remember those bad things. And I know that there were good times as well. But I grew up with my dad and my stepmom the first, like, 8 years of my life. And my stepmother had mental illness. So it was constantly kind of crazy and insane in the household. One minute everything would be okay, the next minute things would be flying across the room. And again, I really allowed a lot of that rage that I had from that situation define in my mind as to why I was the way that I was. And what I know today is that my stepmom's just a really sick human. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that. When I was 8, my brother and I decided to run away. During that time is when I also had my first drink. My first drink was with the person who I've always admired and just adored and worshipped the ground she walked on, and it was my mom. And she got a six-pack, and she handed me a beer. And I remember just thinking, like, I've arrived, you know? And the reason I felt that way is because when I was a little girl, if you asked me, "Where do you want to go?" I would say Bentley's. And that was the little Irish pub that she was the manager of. It smelled like urine. Your feet would stick to the floor when you walked. It was absolutely disgusting, right? But if I could go anywhere, that's where I wanted to go. And I knew everybody drank there, you know, and she would make us drinks, and most of the time in the bar without alcohol in them. But after hours, you know, who knows? But and so I would wipe down the tables. I wanted to be a waitress when I grew up. That was, you know, that was my first I want to job. And so when she gave me that beer, I was like, I've arrived. And I was driving down the Cooper Street in Arlington, Texas, and I was holding that beer up because I wanted everybody to see. I was 8, like they knew who I was, right? That I had finally arrived in the club. And something kind of switched in my brain, and it was almost as if I became an adult that day. And, you know, I wasn't a daily drinker or anything like that. And I don't even think I really got drunk. I just probably drank, you know, half of that beer probably. It was really more about that feeling of a part of that alcohol did for me, and that I wanted to be a part of that. Which is kind of interesting because I also, many times when I was a little girl, you know, I lived with my grandparents after that, and they were the ones who took care of my brother and really gave us a stable environment. They were always, they were our rocks. And I would sit at home and I would cry looking out the window, worried about my mom, because I knew that she would be drinking and she would be driving. And one of the fun things that we did as a little girl is she would take me to Jack in the Box and we would get super tacos, and she would be completely intoxicated. And we would go home and we would lay in bed eating our super tacos, right? Like, that was my mom childhood memory. And so, but I also knew the danger of that, because I would come home and see, it would look like her clothes had been dipped in blood from the car accidents. And my mom, my first meeting was actually when my mom got sentenced to AA, and she didn't want to go alone, and she drugged me with her. And I just remember sitting on the floor and it being really smoky. But I was really little then. I think I was probably 6 or so when that happened. So it's like I knew about these warnings of alcohol, of some of the downsides of that, but I still wanted what existed in that bar, in that pub. When I was 10 was when I had my first real drunk, and my brother had a friend over, and I had a crush on my brother's friend. And again, I'm this awkward, weird, redheaded kid with, like, kind of curly hair, and I just always felt weird and his friend came over, and my grandparents were not drinkers. The only reason they had alcohol in the house was in case Grandma ever got sick. Grandpa would make her a hot toddy, take care of her. So he had a bottle of whiskey, and that's it. And I remember everything about that night except for the blackout part. And that would be what most of my drinking would look like. But I remember getting that stool and putting it up against the stove and climbing up there and grabbing that bottle and running upstairs with it. And we just inherently knew how to play quarters, and it was on. Now, the magic happened for me, and that magic was how that liquor felt when it hit the back of my throat and the burn. And it felt like acid on the back of my throat. I was 10. I hadn't eaten anything, and I take this shot of whiskey, and everything, by the time it hit the pit of my stomach, went okay. Because that cute boy that I had a crush on, and my brother, and wanting to be a part of all of that stuff, after a couple of those shots, everything was okay. And I felt like I could breathe for the first time. Because when that liquor hit the bottom of my stomach and my whole body just went warm, man, I have two speeds, y'all. Stop and fast. That's it. Stop and fast. So, and that's what it looks like, because when you give me something I like, I want more, and I want it now. And so I proceeded to get unbelievably drunk. They then dared me $20. I couldn't finish off the rest of that liquor, and I downed it, you know. To say I had alcohol poisoning is like an understatement of what that felt like, right? I proceeded to leave my DNA all over that house, and I wet my pants. I mean, you name it, it happened that night. The boy, I punched him. I knocked him down the steps. Like, who needs boys, you know? But the really magical thing that occurred for me, not that that's not enough magic in itself, but the really magical thing that happened was my brother was saying these horrible things to me, because he would call me horrible names, and it was just awful. And I was laying on the couch, and everything was spinning. I mean, the world was spinning, and it was spinning around me is what it felt like, you know. And my brother was over there yelling at me, and it was like, wah, 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 wah. I didn't hear it. Like, I knew I heard stuff going on in my ears, but I didn't hear it in here. I didn't hear it in my heart where it hurt so bad when people would say things, and I was so sensitive. That is the magic of alcohol for me. And no matter what the consequences were, from that moment until January 12th of 1992, anytime I could get my hands on it, I would take as much as I could, as quick as I could, to get that relief from having to worry about what you thought of me, or how you felt about me, or how I looked, or what was going on in the world, because it no longer mattered once alcohol hit my body. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, and I loved that effect. Again, I'm 10. I didn't become a daily drinker at 10, but I knew the solution to my life. And from that moment on, like I said, as hard as I could, as quick as I could, I drank as much as I could and as often as I could. And I'm fortunate. I lived in a big city. It was not hard to get alcohol, at least for my brother and I. We had older cousins, and I got in a lot of trouble. And I can say that some of the trouble I got in was actually when I was sober, because I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and I was a violent person. I was violent when I was sober. I wasn't violent when I was drunk. You give me alcohol, and that's my medication, and I am okay. But if you mess with me when I don't have alcohol in me, I am a vile human being, you know? Like, I'm going to tear somebody up. And so all of this hurt and anger and rage that I had from an early childhood, just really, like, as I got older, 11, 12, that stuff just festered inside of me. So when I was sober, I got kicked out of pretty much every school I went to. And, you know, the great thing is I lived with my grandparents, and my grandma always called me her little angel, her little redheaded angel. When I got sober, she said that my halo hangs around my ankles. But she would never think that my brother and I were doing the things that we had been doing. So we were able to get away with a lot. We got in a lot of trouble, and a lot of things happened that they never found out about. But every time we got our hands on alcohol, it was on. And I can say that some of that happened with my brother, but as things progressed, it got worse with me. And again, I just loved that effect because I would just be at a party and I would be fine once I had alcohol in my body. When I was 13 is when I got thrown in my first treatment center. And leading up to that point, I had started that sense of isolation, but I was still going to parties. I was still, I still had some sense of wanting to be social and a part of, because that's what it gave me the ability to do. I couldn't go up and talk to you if I was sober, but if I was drinking, I could. And I still had that sense of social, being social. And I had also gotten into other substances at that point. That's part of what got me thrown in treatment. So during that time period, and I was in treatment all in all about 6 months. I kicked the window out of the treatment center at one point and ended up in Oak Cliff. So there were some stints that I was not in treatment during that time, but I was supposed to be in treatment during that time. What I learned in treatment is drugs are bad, just say no, and that I wasn't an alcoholic. Because I meant to get drunk every time. Like, being powerless over alcohol means that, I mean, I meant to do it, so I had power over the drink, you know? And that made complete sense to me. I mean, I just didn't understand why you people made such a big deal. Because in my mind, that progression of how we get to this place of not being able to differentiate the true from the false, that already existed. It got a whole lot worse, but it still existed at that point to where I felt like you're making a big deal out of something that's really not that big of a deal. And so I did the next right thing with everybody that I was in treatment with. We got drunk together because I wasn't an alcoholic. So our first night out, we went to a huge party, and I got totally lit. And from that moment on, it was... I drank with a vengeance from that moment on, and it wasn't a conscious thought. It was somewhat an uncontrollable one, but I didn't know it at the time, because in my mind, again, I thought, I'm drinking because I want to be drinking, and I have control over the situation that's going on. When I was in treatment, I also met this girl. Her name was Abby. She was the first girlfriend I ever had, because, again, I was super awkward, weird, couldn't talk to people, really shy. I mean, people would never say that I'm a shy person, but I was really shy and terrified. And so I never really had girlfriends. And Abby was kind of my first girlfriend. And I always hung out with my brother and his friends. So this girl, we're hanging out, and she's trying to do this sober thing, which I thought was kind of stupid. But, you know, like, I'm a supportive friend. So I would get shot glasses and set them up for her so that she could drink at parties with us. And I'd just fill them up with water, you know, like, I'm supportive. I'm a good friend. And she would carry these coins around in her pocket. And, you know, I had been forced to go to AA, and I thought, when I was in treatment, I had been forced to go to the AA meetings. And I just kept thinking, like, these people are way too cheery. You know, like, everybody, I would cross my arms and try to be, like, you know, I was tough. And I would be very aggressive. And they were unaffected by that, just completely unaffected. And they would keep their smiling, like, keep coming back. And I was just like, whatever. I just thought it was so silly. And so... So Abby was carrying around these little chips, you know, whatever. And eventually, of course, Abby drinks, right? And this progresses on. And eventually she got sober, and she had gotten, I don't know, 30 or 60 days at that time. And she said to me, it was around October. And at this point, I was a daily drinker. I kept half gallon jugs of vodka in my closet. The first thing that I did before I went to school was I drank vodka before I went to school, because that's what every 14-year-old's doing, you know? And again, so I talk about, like, that insanity, and that's the insanity in terms of me being able to differentiate the true from the false of what a normal person sees as they watch the madness of the alcoholic, and me convincing the people in my life that they're the crazy ones. I'm not the crazy ones. Just leave me alone and I'll be okay. Because you don't understand. Because if you felt the way that I felt, and how I felt inside was like the world would kill me. How I felt was going to kill me. I felt the pain that I felt whenever I was not intoxicated was going to kill me. And so this is around October that Abby tells me, I'm not going to watch you kill yourself. And not once did I think to myself, I should stop drinking. This is a problem. She was my first and, like, real girlfriend, and I was like, bye, Abby. I mean, I didn't think twice about it, because anything that came in front of me getting the relief I needed was not going to be a part of my life. And that was a big part of my first step once I finally got sober. And I didn't realize that that was going to be a big part, because when it talks about no human power could have relieved us of our alcoholism, I know that to be true, because at that point, when you're 14, the most important people in your life, they're your friends. I mean, it's not your family. At 14, you don't want to be hanging out with your mom, you know? You want to be hanging out with your friends, and the only people, and the people who I consider to be my friends, we'll go on to that, because that, again, progressed, because it started with, you know, people who were a couple of years older, and, you know, when I was 13, I had an 18-year-old boyfriend, which I thought was completely normal, and I couldn't understand why my family was so upset with that. And then I started hanging out with these guys that were 20 and 30 years old, right? And we refer to those people as pedophiles today, but at the time, they were my friends, right? And so that's the progression of where my mind was the more I drank, and the scariness of that, because I also got to this place of isolation. Before I went in treatment that first time, there was some level of socialization that I was still participating in. And it got to a place, it was an end in a means. The reason I was hanging out with these guys that were 20 and 30 years old is because I could get what I wanted and what I needed. And I was hanging out in, you know, the sordid places that we talk about. Not where I would see myself, because I was raised not to be a heathen child, as my grandfather would call it. But, you know, I wasn't raised to be that way. But at the time, it just seemed that was just my life, and I didn't understand why everybody had such a problem with it. So Abby's gone, and I continue to drink, and I was a daily drinker. And what happened is that alcohol stopped doing for me what it had initially done for me. And every time I drank, I got drunk. I didn't pick up a drink one time and not get loaded. There's just no sense in it to me. I still don't really understand the mentality of it. I mean, I see people do it, and I think, like, that's really pretty, you know? That's really cute. Like, I wish I could have a little cute glass, and, like, that would be cute. But that's just not what it looks like. The Vera Wang gown would be tied around my waist, and I would be trying to hook up with the groom. That's what that looks like in my life. So I go on. I continue. I'm drinking. But I'm starting to isolate myself, and I'm drinking alone most of the time. The majority of my drinking is alone, and alcohol isn't doing for me what it did do for me. I'm one of those fortunate people. There were a lot harder drugs than I ever took that I never got my hands on, and thank God, because I wouldn't be standing here before you, and I really don't believe I would be alive. Because alcohol took me to this place of isolation and loneliness. You know, that I don't ever want to be there again, right? And at the end, for me, it made complete sense for me to take my own life. I got to a place to where, so like the shave in the head and like the black eyes and the black makeup and beating people up for no good reason. Like, I was just really cruel and a really mean, awful human being. And all of that was just to keep you away from me. Because nobody goes up to the person who looks crazy and is like, how are you doing today? You know, like, they're not really concerned. They would prefer send you to jails, institutions, right? Like, that's the place we need to send people like you to. And so that isolation got me to a place of loneliness that I had never experienced before. And when I hit my bottom, I didn't know that I was hitting my bottom, because what happened is on January 11th, this had been going on for weeks, that I was drinking and I had no relief. I didn't have that sense of comfort that came from taking a couple of drinks. It did not exist anymore. And no matter how drunk I got, no matter how loaded I got, it did not matter, and it did not touch the hurt and the pain. How I felt when I ingested any kind of mood-altering substance is the same way I felt before I took it. And that, to me, was this gift of desperation that my higher power knew to give me in order to get me to my knees, to a place that I was willing to do the things that would come before me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm a defiant human, if anybody hasn't kind of picked up on that, that knows me, I am. If you tell me to do something, I'm just going to do the opposite to let you know that I can do it. You know, like, that's just who and what I am. And that submission for me was super important. And that submission was brought by suffering and pain. And on January 11th, I was in my room, and I wasn't thinking like I'm alcoholic and I need help. I was drinking my face off. And what happened was I was just in this immense pain that had continued on for weeks. And I was sitting there alone, and the loneliness felt like it was going to encompass and just kill me. And I just wanted to die. And the truth that I received in that moment of desperation was that I was able to see myself for truth. Because up to that point, if you asked me why I did the things that I did, how I was the way that I was, I would blame my father, I would blame my stepmother, I would blame all of these people in my life for not loving me the way that you should have loved me or treating me the way that you should have treated me. I never would have taken any kind of personal responsibility. And what I knew in that moment was that I would be better off not in this world, and that that was truth. And the reason that was truth was because I didn't offer anything to society, my family, or anybody else. I was a nasty human being. And the way that I treated my own family was horrible. I didn't speak to them. I was annoyed if they asked me questions. And these are the people, the really nice people who didn't retire so that they could take care of two children that weren't even their own. But how dare you ask me a question of how my day was? I just got to this place of rage and anger, and I knew it in that moment that that was the truth. And my prayer that night wasn't like, I want to get to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober. Right? This is not where I wanted to end up, people. If you want to end up here, keep coming back. You know, like, that is not what I was wanting. I didn't want to be like the, you know, Saturday night speaker at 77 years. That's not what I wanted. So my prayer that night was, if there is anything out there, because I had lost faith in God when I went through all of the insanity as a little kid, and I was 8 years old and it was insanity in that household. I would sit and I would pray and I would say, God, please let me be with my mama. And that never happened. My mom was never able to be a mom when I was a kid. And in my mind as a little kid, all I knew is like, well, God just doesn't have time for you. He's got bigger things to worry with, you know? And so I really didn't think that there was anything out there that was going to help me. But for whatever reason, I said that prayer that night because I was desperate. And I said, if there's anything out there, please don't let my, make my heart stop. Don't let me wake up in the morning. I was at a place that I didn't even know how to come up with a way to kill myself. You know, I had tried to kill myself before, but I was just at zero. I was defeated and I had nothing left. And I can say that that's probably the hardest and the most honest prayer I ever said. I didn't want to end up here. That's not what I prayed for, God, right? But what happened is that girl that I hadn't heard from since October of the previous year, she called me and said, do you want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with me? The next morning when I woke up. The last place I wanted to go was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Did not want to end up there. But again, I had gotten to that place. And for me, my bottom wasn't about, you know, I wish I'd, you know, like, I heard this speaker recently, and he really did rob a bank right before he got sober. I was like, that is so cool, except he had to go to prison, which wasn't cool. But, you know, like, I didn't do anything super cool. I don't have, like, this fantastic finale of what that bottom looked like. But what it was that desperation, that loneliness and emptiness. But what I know is that prior to me getting here, you know, I got here 6 days before my 15th birthday. The room that I went to was this little trailer, and it was these old men with like Santa Claus beards and suspenders. I mean, they were old dudes, you know? And one of the guys, he was a multimillionaire. He drank all of his money away. And I just remember thinking, that guy's stupid, you know? Like, what were you thinking? Like, how did you end up under a bridge, you know? Like, I did not get that. I mean, and that was in the first couple months. Today, like, I get that. But at the time, I just didn't get it. I was like, what have I walked into, you know? I didn't have anything on the outside in common with anybody in that room. I just didn't. They didn't look like me. They weren't where I was. But when they talked about that loneliness, that emptiness, the fear, and I would say the fear is probably the thing that in the first 6 months that kept me coming back. was when they talked and identified about the emotion of fear. Because up till that point, I would have told you I'm not scared of anything. Because I really believed and thought that. But when you people talked about it, I identified. When you talked about that emptiness and that loneliness and that jumping off place. Because what I know today is that it doesn't make any sense to think about killing yourself. God didn't create us to think that way, really, right? God created us to, like, procreate and spread and, like, stay alive. Like, that's what we're supposed to do. Clothe ourselves, feed ourselves, stay alive. I got to a place, alcohol takes me to this place that it makes complete sense and seems like the only solution to my problem is for me to take my own life. And that, for me, is what my bottom was about. And being able to identify with these men that, in my mind, I had nothing in common with, I could identify with that. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I clearly didn't look like you, and y'all were unaffected by me. I mean, those old guys, and when I say old guys, they were old, and they were unaffected. They didn't tell me, I spilt more than you drank, and I know a lot of people have heard that or said that, and my experience is that the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous never did that with me. What they did is they got me a cup of coffee, and they brought it over to me. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope. That's my experience. My experience, those guys just loved me right into the rooms. Now, that love also consisted of truth, which I didn't like that when I got here. And they weren't shy to give me that truth. Because they let me know where the door was if I wasn't willing to do the things that they did. And when I came in, I said I was an alcoholic, because all you people, you go around the circle and you all say that you're alcoholic. So, of course, you know, when in Rome, that's the reason I did it. I mean, I really, to my innermost self, did I believe I was alcoholic? No. It was the process of going through the book with a sponsor that I was able to identify my alcoholism. And if you're new, I encourage you to do that. Maybe you're going to be a lucky person and end up not alcoholic. You know, that would be cool. It wasn't my experience, unfortunately. But I got a sponsor, and I took the suggestions. And why did I take the suggestions? Because that amount of suffering of getting to a place where it made sense to take my own life, that was great enough to create me to do certain actions, because I was completely helpless. I was out of ideas. And our book talks a lot about old ideas. And I wasn't really keen on giving up any ideas prior to that week, probably. Because even 2 days before, if you had told me to do something, I'd do the exact opposite. But for whatever reason, I started taking these suggestions and doing the silly little things that you people suggest, which really, I'm just going to go ahead and say to new people, none of it makes any sense. Doesn't. I still, to this day, I call my sponsor, got something going on in my life. She says, well, did you pray about it? And I think, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I don't know why you would ask me a question like that. Really. I mean, I've got like 20 other resources I can do before I break down to praying about it, you know? So, like, keep coming back, right? Like, that's what I know, is just keep coming back, and that's what's worked for me. And so I started doing the silly things. They said to pray. I said, I don't believe in God. They said, that's okay. You don't have to believe to pray. You can still pray and not believe. And I'm like, all right. I'm going to show you people this is not going to work. I'm going to do everything that you tell me to do. And in a year, la, 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 I'm going to get drunk, you know? And in my mind, I really thought that. I really thought, like, because I'm an all or nothing. I have stop and fast, two speeds, right? So I'm going to do it all. I'm going to do everything you tell me to do. And when it doesn't work, I get to drink my face off because you told me I could. So off I go. Unfortunately, what happened is, like, Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I realize I'm one of you people and I belong here. So I start doing the work and I start doing the deal. And I'll tell you that a lot of people also tell me how fortunate I am that I got sober at a young age. And believe me, there are huge advantages to getting Alcoholics Anonymous young. But there's a lot of disadvantages to that, too, because I can tell you that when I was 15 years old and I had 6 days sober and I went to school, I was still at that place of wanting to kill myself. And I came home and I said, I can't go back to school. Because it felt like it was going to kill me. I was freaking out. I checked myself into treatment. I was probably about 6 days sober when that happened. And I don't know what the people at school thought, but I left school with half my head shaved and like combat boots and black. I was just like, you know, scary looking human. And I came back and I was like in button up and like Cole Haans and like matching furs. They were probably like, where did that girl go? Rehab in the 90s. So I had to seek some outside help, because what I know is that I also had a lot of trauma. I was 14 years old and I was living a life like a 30-year-old human. That's not normal, right? And so I needed to get outside help and address some of those things so that Alcoholics Anonymous could also work. And I went to meetings during that time and I got active, and I would go, you know, once I got out of treatment and I got back in school, and it's not fun going to school. I mean, I actually had to go to school to learn, you know, like I didn't go to school to do other things like extracurricular or to have friends. I actually went there to learn, because after I stopped drinking, there was nothing else to do there. So, and you know, my fun was like hanging out with old people playing Pictionary on Friday night. Like that was like, let's go play Pictionary. And we would be at the restaurants, and I'd be like, please, God, don't let anybody I know walk in and see me with these people, because I'm not claiming them as my family. You know, like, it looked like the little yellow bus had just dropped us all off. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, look at your table. You know what I mean? Like, look at your table, right? We don't fit. Like, none of us fit. Like, how do you know that person? A friend of a friend, you know? Like, it was weird, and I'm 15 years old hanging out with, like, you know, 60, 70-year-old people. It was weird, super weird. But what I also know about that time period is it was really beautiful, because I learned how to have fun, like real just good old-fashioned fun, you know, like playing Pictionary and hanging out. And, you know, after like 6 or 7 months, I started going to NA on the weekends so that I could go to dances and hang out with, like, 30-year-olds, you know, like... I was not socialized with people in my own, I didn't know how to talk to people my own age for a long period of time in sobriety. I mean, and even today, my BFF, Kathy O, 65. Oh, 66. I'm sorry. I'm 66. So, you know, so like, I just didn't know how to relate to people my own age. And so, you know, that was some of the downfalls of being early on sober, being so young, and where the community that I got sober in was exactly what I needed at the time that I needed. And I'm so grateful that I got sober with old people who told me where the door was if I needed to hit it. I'm glad that I received the love of being embraced and having the biggest cheerleaders at the table cheering for me. And it was a safe place, because none of them were predators. I kept thinking, they keep telling me they love me. I know they want something, you know, like, I did not understand, love you, keep coming back, weird, right? But what I can say is those people, they treated me like I was their child. In fact, I actually brought this young guy to a meeting with me, and it was in my first year of sobriety, and I think I was probably 6 months sober, and Ken was there, and this was a guy I had actually drank with, and, I mean, he probably fell into that pedophile category, actually. But anyway, I brought him to the meeting with me, and Ken said, are you a 13th stepper? And, you know, this guy's not an AA. He's like, what's a 13th stepper? And, he, you know, Ken proceeded to tell him what a 13th stepper, and he was like, no, sir, I'm not one of those things, you know. And he said, well, good, I'm a 14th stepper. I beat up 13th steppers, you know, like... So it's important as a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous that we create this safe environment. And I'm so grateful to the gentlemen who were gentlemen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had a lot of those in my sobriety. So, you know, I did the deal. I went through the steps. They told me to stay out of a relationship my first year. Most people say, oh, well, you were only 15. Well, I was acting like I was 30, so it was a big deal to me. Whether it was a big deal to you or not, I did not like that suggestion. I thought it was about as stupid as praying, but I still took those suggestions in spite of the fact that I thought that they were dumb. And on the 366th day, I met this really nice guy, and I married him. I know y'all are going to be really shocked to know that we're not married today, but we're not. But that leads into how I ended up in North Carolina. He was in the Marine Corps, and I was 3.5 years sober. I had this community, and I had gone through all 12 steps multiple times, and I ended up moving to North Carolina where people just didn't know how to do AA. And if you've moved in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know how when you move somewhere, they just don't do it the way that they're supposed to. And I'm sure we all have that experience of trying to, you know, beat them into doing it the way that we learned, and that just doesn't work. But that was my experience, and I remember just sitting in the back of meetings and just being like, you poor people are going to get drunk, you know. Y'all need to go down to Texas and learn how to do it. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous where I live, and I've been in Wilmington since 1995, and North Carolina taught me about service. You know, Texas gave me my foundation, but North Carolina taught me about service. Because in the first 3.5 years, man, I was a taker. I was going to all these conventions. I didn't know how any of this stuff got set up. Props to all the committee, right? So much work goes into making this happen. But I was just a taker, you know, in those first 3.5 years, which is exactly where I needed to be. But when I got to North Carolina, I learned some things about service. And I didn't go into that wanting to do that either. I went to this meeting because somebody had told me to, because I was at that place where I was judging all of you. I didn't want to be in, you know, the meetings anymore. I was like, this is stupid. I wasn't actively working one-on-one with a face-to-face sponsor. And I go to this meeting, and this guy's talking. One of my heroes. Giants of AA, right? This guy's a giant in AA. And he's talking about how important it is that when he's in a meeting and he's not hearing what it is he needs to hear to share his experience that was so freely given to him. And it was like a dagger in my heart because I was judging all you people, but I was not sharing the experience that the early members had taught me. They taught me about being a responsible AA member and showing up early and shaking people's hands. They taught me how to be a responsible AA member. And I was not doing that. I was just judging all you people. And so I thought, okay, I did what I was going to do in Texas. I'm going to go to a conference is what I think. And so I go to this conference, and I'd never been to a young people's conference before. I didn't even know how to talk to people my own age. I go to this conference, and all of these young people are hooting and hollering and chanting and acting just a fool. And I was like, these are my people, you know. I was like, oh, my God. You know, I'd never met people who were young and sober and had that kind of enthusiasm. And we put a bid in for that conference. Like, I just grouped up with some other people in Wilmington, and we decided, okay, we're going to bid on this conference. And those crazy fools gave us the conference and let us put it together. And so we come back, and like, my life just exploded. And it talks in the big book about how God will show us how to create the fellowship that we crave. And what I crave has changed over the years, right? Like what I craved when I was 20, I assure you, is not what I'm craving today. But at that time, man, it was exactly what I needed. And we just toured the country. I ended up going through a divorce during that time period. I had a lot of health problems during that time period, but service just engulfed me. And I was on all these committees and going all over the place and acting like a 20-year-old, which basically means I was doing super inappropriate things that, you know, in our steps are probably not considered to be spiritual. And what I know today, that's another downfall about being sober really young, is that most of you can blame the things that I did sober. Y'all got to do it drunk, and y'all could be like, I was drunk. Not me. I had to go like 10 years sober with an inventory with my sponsor, just ashamed, right? My tail between, because I knew right from wrong. So anyway, I did a lot of inappropriate things. And I say this to say that we have a triangle, service, unity, and recovery. And service is so important. Man, I have to constantly be participating in the program of recovery that's laid out in the big book. Because if I'm not, man, I get into this thing, it's called gray area for this alcoholic, justifying my behavior and the things that I do and how I do things. And then I end up doing things that create shame, remorse, and guilt. And what I know about those things is they will lead me to a drink if left unattended. And so I got to this place, I was 7 years sober, and I just wanted to go to bed and never wake up again. I hadn't picked up a drink yet, and I hadn't killed myself yet. But I've watched enough people with double-digit sobriety kill themselves either in sobriety or go back out. And I ended up changing sponsors at that time, and I had a sponsor that just at that time was patting me on the back, telling me, keep coming back, it's going to get better. And my experience is that keep coming back, it's going to get better, does not work long term. It works initially, but long term, that is not the solution for me. The solution for me is laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's in those 12 steps, and it's by working and practicing those steps. And so I got back into that step work, and I went through a lot of health problems, and I did a lot of writing of inventory, and I started making some amends. And some of those amends consisted of my amends with my father. He's the one that I talk about in my story, because he was the hard one. Mom's easy. I've always felt love from my mom. The beautiful thing about Mom, and I talk about, you know, the beginning of our story, is that Mom gave me my first drink. Mom was alcoholic, y'all. Mom's sober alcoholic today. I get to go to conferences with my mom today. My mom gets to show up and be a mom, and it's because you people taught her how to be a mom. Because she didn't know how to do that stuff, y'all. And I remember being, even when she was 6 years sober, thinking, man, I'm never going to have a mom. And I went through a hard time like 7 years ago, and man, my mom showed up. And ever since then, our relationship shifted and changed. And what you people also taught me was how to let my mom be a mom, which means my mom worries about me. My mom sometimes wants to send me $100. My mom does things for me. I don't like accepting help from anybody because I learned how to take care of myself from an early age. And you people taught me how to accept love and how to allow this woman to have her dignity and grace back of being a mom. My dad was the hard one. When I was 7 years sober, I was still thinking, I hope he dies alone. I can't wait till that man is sick and dying. And I want him to be alone. And I meant that with everything in me. And my stepmom, I had like homicidal thoughts about her, and I would think about beating her with my bare hands 3.5 years sober. That's just what it looked like for me. Where there is great hurt takes so much longer time, at least for me it did. And what I encourage you to do is that if you have those hard relationships, keep writing that inventory. And it seems so stupid, keep writing the same thing over and over and over. But what my experience is that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as I keep doing the work, it eventually happens. And that's what happened with my dad. And it happened as a result of me hitting the bottom with my dad. I was so angry, and I was furious with him. And I called my sponsor, Matt, and she said, well, when you're ready to write some inventory, give me a call. Click. If you don't ever want to punch your sponsor in the throat, get a new sponsor. Because my experience is super important to want to punch your sponsor in the throat. Because ego deflation, right? That's not what I wanted to hear that day. But as a result, that rage that I felt when she said that to me and I hung up the phone, I hit my knees and I cried. And that's about what it takes to make me hit my knees and cry, right? I hit my knees and I start crying. And when I was on my knees and I was praying, I had this vision. And the vision was my father when I was 8 years old. And we had gone back to the house and we had to pick up our things when we decided we were running away from home. And it was just his eyes. All I could see in that vision was his eyes. And they were really sad. And I had this thought that that must have been hard for him when his child decided, I don't want to live with you anymore. And I can tell you it didn't take away the hurt, it didn't take away the pain. But it gave me a tiny bit of willingness to keep doing the work. Which meant that my sponsor gave me instructions as to how to start the process after I wrote that inventory. And that process was to start really slow. And I started writing him a card. Every month I would write him a card. And I hated writing some of those cards. Now, some of them weren't hard, but some of them I didn't want to do. And then after a year and a half of doing that, she said, I want you to call your dad on a regular basis. Be consistent. Our work is about being consistent. Just like when we go into institutions, it's important for us to be consistent. Service is what taught me how to show up on time, to be there when I'm supposed to be there. And that was what my step work was about with him. So I did that. And sometimes, my dad still didn't call me on my birthday. He still didn't call me at Christmas. My dad didn't change who and what he was, and still hasn't to this day. But what I became is who my God intends for me to be in my relationship with my father. And I learned how to be a good daughter in a really hard situation. And around that time, I had previously gone through 5 operations, 3 years of chemo. After that, I found out I had a hole in my heart and I was getting ready to have open heart surgery. And I called my dad. I was 26 at the time. And I said, "Dad, I got to have this surgery." And he said, "I'll be there." And I remember thinking, "He's not going to be there." And I hung up the phone like, "He's not coming." 2 weeks later, right before I went under for that surgery, I got to look my dad in the eye and I got to make formal amends to him that I meant from the bottom of my soul when I said, "You deserve a better daughter, and I was not the daughter that you deserved." And I meant that. I no longer wanted him to die alone, because it was no longer about how my dad loved me. It was about me learning how to be the person that my higher power intends for me to be in my relationships. And I can tell you that that process, it was a long one. It did not happen overnight. A couple years later, after that incident, I was with my dad. And, you know, when I go home now, we always go for a ride on my dad's Harley. And my dad said to me, "You're a Texas girl. Why don't you move home?" Had he said that to me 6 years before, I would have said, "You're always trying to control me. You just want me under your thumb so you can control me." What you people taught me is how to listen to what my father said. And what my dad said was, "I miss you and I wish you were home on the weekends so that we could go for rides on the Harley." Because my dad doesn't know how to say that, right? My dad knows how to say, "You're a Texas girl, why don't you move home?" You people taught me how to listen. And you also taught me how to not focus on how people treat me, but to show up to be the best self that I can be today. As a result of work in the 12 steps, and as a result of seeing these giants in Alcoholics Anonymous that did things that made no sense as to why they did it. In my first home group, this guy was, his son had killed his wife and his daughter. He came home and his wife and daughter had been murdered. That guy showed up to meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a consistent basis, and after about 6 months, he hired an attorney for his son because he said, "That's what my wife would have wanted." That wasn't of himself that he did that. That was of a power that was much greater than myself that I always think is the worst solution to my problem. But what I can say is that it's always the best solution to my problem. When I surrender and I'm open to whatever the universe is going to put into my world, right? And so you people taught me how to be a lady. You taught me how to do unbelievable things in sobriety. You know, I've had a great life, and I have like this tribe that I love. And there's been times that things have been beautiful in my life, that I've thrived, and I've just thought, this is so amazing. Like, and it's really good to be grateful when everything's good, right? Like, that's easy. But we are really proud of ourselves when we're grateful, no matter what the circumstances are. But I've also experienced really hard times in sobriety. And I fought to find that gratitude. And I would say probably the last 7 years have been the hardest of my recovery. And for a lot of different reasons. A lot of it has been to do with death and loss, right? Like, I've experienced a lot of that. But the blessings in that is that there's always those silver linings. One of my biggest things on my first inventory that I was so ashamed of was the kind of friend that I was. Because the person I was is I would steal from you and I'd help you look for it. Right? That's who and what I was. You know, one of my best friends got sick and she had cancer. And, you know, like, I got to show up and I got to hold her hand. And it's not like you see in the movies, you know what I mean? It's not like you say the things you want to say and they pass peacefully and everything's okay. That's just not what it looks like. It was really hard and it was really ugly. And she actually lived in Atlanta, right? And I was driving to Atlanta every weekend to hold her hand because you people taught me how to be a friend. You taught me how to show up for my tribe, my people, you know? Um, I've got to have all of these wonderful people in my life, and some of them I've lost. Some of them I've lost as a result of the disease of alcoholism. But you people taught me how to walk through that and how to do it with some level of dignity and grace. And service has been the key part that has been consistent in my life. I later went on, like, I served in a lot of different roles, and I went on to serve as a delegate to the General Service Conference, which was such an honor and a privilege, and to serve my area, the area that taught me about service. I don't know what your gift is, but I hope you find it. I believe we all have one. It could be just one-on-one with that newcomer. It might be at your intergroup, central office, right? We all have a gift. Find that gift and find that passion in your service. Corrections, institutions. There are alcoholics still dying on a regular basis because I have this disease that takes me to a place that it makes sense for me to take my own life. And we come here and we get to laugh and we get to, like, experience such joy. I've been looking forward to this weekend. I'm in a new career, and in my new career, like, I have just been getting it, and I haven't had a weekend off, and I was so excited that I got to come this weekend and be with my people, you know, and laugh. I mean, we laugh so hard. I swear, I was crying on the way here, because Sylvia just makes me laugh so hard. I just love her, man. She just tickles me, the things she says. I always say she's right about 2% of the time, you know. I love new people because they just give me this joy. And I remember my old timers, they would, like, call me out in the middle of a speaker meeting. And I remember just thinking, oh my God, you know. But I look back at those people, and some of those people are gone. One of them's Mike, and I'm going to close with this story because, you know, Dr. Bob had his last drink, you know, 83 years ago, right? And our fellowship is about this gift of passing on the message. And my old timers, what they look like is they show up when they're dying. They're still passing the message on. And the story's about my guy, Mike. And Mike, he was the funniest guy you'd ever meet. He was completely inappropriate. He would spend 4 hours a day praying for people. Like, he was that guy, super spiritual, really spiritual guy, really inappropriate also. Like, I mean, the things that would come out of his mouth, or I can't even say them from up here. If you want to know, I'll tell you out there, but I can't say them from up here. And funny. He taught me how to love. He allowed me to love him as he was dying. He ended up with cancer. He had lung cancer and emphysema. And in the last couple months that he was alive, he had, like, 5 of us. And this was a process, too, because I think for people like us, sometimes it's hard to accept help. I know for me it is. But he allowed us to come into his home and to take care of him as he was dying, before he was full on in a hospice center. And so I was single, so I got 2 nights out of the week, and everybody else got 1 night out of the week. And we would go in, and he would be like, okay, go make me a shake, do 10 Hail Marys and an Our Father, and it'll be ready. Like, he required prayer and everything that he did to determine how long it would take to do anything. He would also come in, you'd go in, how you doing, Mike? Oh, just sitting here pooping my pants, you know, like, he's, like, dying, and he's funny, and he was a hoot, right? And he was like a dad to me, man. I mean, when I didn't have a dad, he was one of those people that was like a dad. My higher power always gives me exactly what I need, and he was one of those people. At that time, I was sponsoring this girl, and she was a total just train wreck of a drunk. And she would say that she was sober. She wasn't really sober. Like, I could smell it. Everybody could smell it. I felt like I needed a white chip for hanging out with her and giving her a ride. I mean, it was bad. And she would, like, wait and try to figure out, like, do I get a white chip now? Like, can I get 30 days yet? Like, she's always scheming. And this went on for a couple months. Well, Mike's dying. And it's Monday night. It's my home group. And right before that had been my anniversary weekend. And that anniversary weekend, I had this brunch for all the women that I sponsored, and to thank them for the recovery that I had. And in that meeting, we had a meeting about the spiritual principle that had impacted our lives the most that year, and she started crying, and she was like, I can't get honest. I try to not pick up a drink. I go home, and I'm like, don't pull into the liquor store. Don't pull in. And she's like, I end up in the liquor store. I end up at the gas station, and I hide the bottles in my little niece's, you know, three-year-old niece's closets. Like, I can't stop. I don't know why I can't stop. I can't stop. And so we all surround her, and the next night was my home group, and we take her to the home group, and she picks up her white chip. And when I was at that meeting, Keith was there, and Keith was prayer partners with Mike. They had been prayer partners for 28 years, I believe. And I said, how's Mike? Because he had been in hospice at that point. Because I hadn't seen him that day, and he said, he's not doing good today. You know, you should stop by and see him. And I thought, okay, mental note, I need to stop by and see him. We all go to dinner, which of course takes 5 hours because nobody can figure out what restaurant to go to. And we have dinner. And then afterwards, this young girl, and now granted, I tell you, I made this brunch, like I had this huge event. I was exhausted. I was so tired. All I wanted to do was go home. I was so excited to like eat, full belly, go home, sleep. And she looked at me and she said, I'm afraid to go home. Can I come home with you? Man, the last thing I wanted to do was to hang out with her. I did not want to hang out with her. And be careful, because she didn't leave for like 3 years. So when you tell them they can come home with you, be careful. But I was like, okay, yeah, you can come to my house. And so we go to my house. And then all of a sudden, I remember I hadn't been by to see Mike. And I said, hey, will you take me up there? And so we go up there. And right when we walked in, it was apparent that he wasn't going to make it through the night. You know, his breathing was lapsed, and he was having a hard time. And we all sat there. And this girl, she's like me too. Like, especially anytime you do anything super religious, she freaks out a little bit. I mean, she's not into that. And Mike was devout Catholic, right? His favorite prayer was the rosary. I mean, he's on his dying bed, right? So what are we going to do? We sit down and we start praying the rosary. I got this new girl that's got 24 hours next to me, and like the hairs are standing up on her neck. She's like, oh God, right? And we're sitting there, and his breathing's just getting slower and slower and slower. And we're sitting there, and we're praying, and we all have our hands on him. And he takes his last breath. And I don't know if any of you have had the privilege to be with somebody and hold their hand. A month ago, almost to the day, one of my other old-timers passed away, and I was with her. But it's an honor to be there. And there's a feeling that you feel when they pass. You know. You feel it. And afterwards, we got to my house, and that girl looked at me, and she said, I don't know what happened in that room. And I don't know if it was God. The only thing I know how to describe is it felt like love. And in my sick, twisted mind, you know, I had been thinking, of course I was with Mike. I was his favorite, you know, like that's what I was thinking. And when she said that, she ruined it for me. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, dang it. New people always get everything, you know? That was his last 12-step call, right? That girl continued to stay sober. She's sober today. I got to walk with her and watch her learn how to be a daughter to her dad, that she didn't even know how to pick up the phone and answer his phone calls. Because of the experiences and the pain and the suffering that I went through with my own relationships, I learned to pass that on. Man, this is the best show in town for a dollar, right? Like, I mean, you just can't make it up. You just can't make it up. And my little lady, she passed away May 8th. She was 50 years sober. And she touched so many people's lives, right? And what we get is we get to continue on giving back all that was given to us by these old-timers, by these giants in Alcoholics Anonymous that show us the way. And I always say, like, you may love AA, but you don't love it more than me, right? And I'm telling y'all can love it the same if you want, but you can't love it more than me. Because what I receive is just so much, no matter how much I give back. And so if you think all this is just kind of BS and it's weird and it's hocus pocus, whatever, keep coming back and just do this silly stuff. It makes no sense. Again, I think the stupidest suggestion my sponsor ever says to me is, well, do you pray about it? I don't like that. I don't want to do it. But my experience is that when I get out of the way, miracles happen. Thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for allowing me to be here.